Inhale, exhale. When I breathe this way, it reminds me of diving. I learned to dive while I was living in Hong Kong. I wanted a feeling of control. I had always been afraid of the ocean. It was too vast, too open, but I wanted to feel lost, with only my breath to guide me. The first time I went diving, staring at the horizon, I remember I thought of Shim Cheung. I had been loaded down with metal weights to make sure that I wouldn't float. Beginners tend to go to the top, the instructor had told me. Stay down. The water was choppy, and the boat was tossing with each high wave. The instructors promised that underneath the water it would be calm. It was just the surface that was broken. I fell backwards into the water, and as I felt myself sink and the cold rush over me, I tried to remember to take deep breaths. It was like counting steps. Being under the water, it was so calm. It reminded me of the calm before a thunderstorm, so still and so silent. We went deeper and deeper, clutching the rocks to keep from being pulled into the deep sea by the current. I tried to sway back and forth with the current, keeping an eye on my oxygen. I looked out into the deep blue, the expanse of darkness, and I felt a sense of terror, of emptiness. And even though I desperately wanted to go back up to the sunlight, away from the blindness of the deep, I forced myself to stay down, watching the glimmer of light be swallowed by the ocean. We are watching the Olympics. It's the ski jumping. Haru is upset because his show is on. Criminal Intent, Channel 28, he says. He's wearing furry slippers and a bathrobe that's slipping off his shoulders. He looks like an old man from a comic book. No, Will says. His legs are crossed on the couch and he's munching on an apple. He's been in his room all day but has come out for the Olympics. Criminal Intent is on every single day, Haru. The Olympics are once every 4 years. 4 years, Haru. Haru looks at the worker in the room. It's Tim, a slight man with a thick accent and a buzz cut. Tim shrugs. Haru, no one wants to watch your stupid show, Will says. Majority rules. Tamira laughs. She has tissues sticking out of her ears because she says she has an earache. Haru looks on the verge of angry tears. He turns and stomps to the glass enclosure. Oh, great, Will says. Now he's going to tell. Emma looks apologetic. He watched Criminal Intent this morning, I remember. Emma took her medication today. At least that's what she told me. I can tell because her eyes are glassy, and she stopped talking so quickly. Instead, she's slumped on the couch, her papers lying forgotten next to her. I try giving her a smile, but she looks past me, as though she can't focus, and she leans back against the cushions. Mick is sitting in his wheelchair by the door. His back is straight. He still has the posture of a military man, and he's rubbing his hands against his shaved head. He turns to Ali. Who do you root for when you watch this stuff? Ali has his eyes closed. He has vapor rub around his nose, and he's taking deep, slow breaths. I vaguely remember hearing that vapor rub helps with panic attacks, and I wonder if that's why I haven't seen him walking the halls today. Ali opens his eyes and raises an eyebrow. USA, obviously. Mick shrugs. Sitting next to me is a new woman. I haven't seen her before. She has dark hair, and she hasn't told anyone her name yet. She's huddled and shivering. She has her sleeves pulled over her hands. We watch the Olympics in silence. I notice that the woman next to me is crying. Tamira is talking to her boyfriend. She sees me waiting and glares at me. I shrug and take a step back. When she hangs up, I notice that she's blinking away tears. She lingers by the phone. I ignore her and dial James's number, a reverse charge call. Hello, darling, he says. Hi, I say. I take a breath. We are being recorded. I wonder if James knows. I hear the familiar clicks in the background. I talked to the doctor, I say. Oh, yes? He sounds eager. What does she say? Did she say you were going to be released? Well, I say, she says that you don't think I'm 100% yet. I try to keep any accusation from my tone. So, I don't know. I think I have to wait a while. There's a silence. And when he speaks slowly. But Kat, you aren't 100%. I thought you knew that. I keep my voice light. I feel basically 100%. Out of the corner of my eye, I see Tamira watching me. I turn so that my back is to her. You aren't. You're different, and that's fine, but you're not yourself yet. He pauses. You don't even ask me how Cato is doing. It's like he doesn't exist. I think it's going to take time, maybe months, or even a year. I don't have a year, I snap. I want to leave here. I can get better when I go home. I'm ready to go home. I know, he says, and I want you home. I told you, it's not up to me. It's okay, I say. James doesn't know. I feel like I'm caught in a reflection of the world, and there isn't a way out. I push aside what he says about Cato. Why can't he understand? It's like Cato doesn't exist. I am in a deep sleep, cocooned to the truth. Even in my numbness, I recognize this fact. This is how you survive as a ghost, I realize. This is how you exist. This is how you surrender. Around me, all I can hear is the sound of the television, the murmur of the workers behind the glass enclosure. I feel like howling. I want to shatter the glass, hold the shards up in my palm. We arrived in New Jersey on a gray day. We had been traveling for 31 days, from San Diego to Los Angeles, to Virginia, and then finally to New Jersey. I was exhausted. We took the Amtrak train, carrying our bags from Washington, D.C. On the train, I thought I had lost our backpack with our passports and a journal that we had been keeping since the start of our relationship. James was wearing Cato in a sling, and he jumped off the train to look for the bag. I heard the train doors close. "Come back," I shouted, but James gestured to me. "I'll see you in New Jersey." "Get on the train." I ran to the conductor, screaming hysterically. "You have to let my husband on board. He has a baby. I need them on the train." I saw James sprinting to the front of the train, and miraculously, the doors opened. "What were you thinking?" I said. "You don't even have any milk, and I have the tickets." James shrugged and smiled at me. My heart was pounding. I must have looked like a madwoman. "It's all fine," James said. "It will all be fine." I was on hold with the lost and found at Union Station when we found the backpack. It had been under the seat. I laughed wildly in relief. This was the moment when I realized that the trip had taken more out of me than I had expected. The sleep deprivation, the constant moving around, everything felt exaggerated. The colors of the world were too vibrant. I felt a breath away from weeping. I was relieved to have reached our final destination. I felt triumphant. We had made it. My in-laws' house was in a New Jersey subdivision with matching roofs and windows and backyards of trees. It was quiet, except for the buzz of highways. New Jersey made me feel uneasy. It reminded me of the scenes from the movies, with identical rows of houses and strip malls that were too bright. My mother-in-law embraced me when we arrived. "Welcome, you're finally home," she said, and I believed it. Even though it was February, there was still tinsel on the walls from Christmas, and we settled in to one of the upstairs rooms. We had only been in the house for a few hours when I realized something didn't feel right. I could hear a noise, a tinny buzzing and beeps that sounded like monitors. "I feel like we're being watched," I said to James. "Hmm? Do your parents have cameras too?" "No," he said, "I don't think so. Don't worry, I'll check." My father-in-law had installed a Purell machine in the house because of the flu season, and each time we came in from outside, he wanted us to gel our hands. It reminded me of the hospital announcement that was on repeat in the maternity ward. "Please gel your hands. Please gel your hands." I could hear the voice, a chorus in my head, echoing. My father-in-law and mother-in-law started to talk about Cato, concerned about the effects of travel on a baby so young. My father-in-law checked Cato's temperature with a thermometer and worriedly counted his fingers and toes, as though he might have lost one on the way. We've planned a 100-day celebration, my mother-in-law said. But don't let anyone hold the baby or get too close. It's flu season, you know. When I had my first baby, I didn't leave the house for 4 months, she said, and no one was allowed to visit. Why did you let so many people hold the baby in California? Each time you posted a photo of someone holding him, your father-in-law would get so scared. What if they had dropped him? And then she told me the story of a baby who had been dropped at a celebration party and died. Don't worry, I said. I tried my best to assuage their fears and address each comment, but it was as though I was speaking into a void. The questions and worries didn't stop. Why was Cato so big? We must not be exercising him enough, because we had always been traveling. Why wasn't he rolling yet? Didn't we know that he should be rolling by now? It must be all the travel. Why did we hold him in a sling? It must be affecting his body. His limbs would grow crooked. Why did he cry so much? He must be stressed because of all the travel. Why wasn't he sleeping through the night? It must be all the time changes and the travel. Was he coughing? Was he sick? Did he have a temperature? Each comment and criticism, although kindly meant, stuck at me like pinpricks of a needle. Was I such a terrible mother? Was I doing everything wrong? I already knew the story of James's uncle, the firstborn son of James's grandfather, who had smiled so widely when he met me. His firstborn son had died when a pot of hot soup fell on him. I told myself that this was why my parents-in-law were cautious, but I started to doubt my own instincts. Should you be feeding him again? My mother-in-law said. You shouldn't overfeed him. He's too big. Well, actually, I meant to be feeding on demand. You should feed him with a bottle. Then I can help you. Why don't you bring a bottle? Do you have any? I want to feed him. I tried to explain that I needed to feed because of my mastitis. This was waved away. If you feed with a bottle, you can pay attention to how much they're eating. Look, he's so big, he can't even move around. And so I started apologizing whenever I took Cato away to be fed. Why are you holding him? He needs to learn to sit on his own. Put him in the swing. Don't hold him. You hold him too much. Cato would scream and scream, and I would stand hovering over him, my whole body leaning towards him, but not able to reach out. Whenever I tried to express concern, my mother-in-law would laugh, exaggerated laughs, and then her eyes would dart towards me. Why was she laughing? I didn't understand. Have you gelled your hands? It's flu season, you know, my father-in-law would say nervously. And then my mother-in-law would laugh again, while gesturing to me to gel my hands. I saw myself as if through a camera lens, rubbing my hands together under the Purell machine. I could feel the sting of the alcohol on my palms. Maybe we shouldn't have come, I said to James. We seem to be causing them a lot of stress. I'm doing everything wrong. Don't worry, James sighed. I knew this was going to be difficult. But don't think about how they think of you. You're fine. They just worry, that's all. My mother-in-law talked excitedly about the 100-day celebration. It was happening in 2 weeks. All of James's New York clan was coming. My parents were going to drive up, and I heard that my sister-in-law was flying in from California. I felt excited, but the idea of so many people was exhausting. 100 days, I thought. 100 days, and Cato would be safe. It was on the 5th day that I decided I had to leave the house for a few hours away. I was tired of being indoors. I wanted to move. I was starting to feel trapped. I felt like I couldn't take breaths, but my decision was met with concern. But it's so cold outside. You shouldn't take Cato outside when it's so cold. He could get the flu. There's a state flu epidemic right now. You can't take him to a crowded area. He could get the flu and die. We can drive you, but you can't take public transportation. It's so crowded in there. If he gets the flu, he'll need a spinal tap. It's very dangerous for babies his age. My father-in-law's face was furrowed. If you want to go, you should go. If you're happy, we're happy, my mother-in-law said. She smiled and laughed while clapping her hands, but she was glancing at me with a look of warning. What did she want me to do? I ended up deciding to stay in the house, just to stop the chorus of caution. Cato screamed often. It was as though he could sense the tension. The house was kept to a high temperature, in line with the Korean tradition that mother and baby should be kept warm. It made me feel even more compressed, like I was being bound. I started being unable to sleep at night. My in-laws' voices were repeating refrains in my head, and I would cry out of frustration. My tears were hot, and I would wipe them with the palms of my hands while I fed Cato, trying to keep them from falling on his cheek. I felt helpless and enraged, but confused and doubting. Maybe I was a terrible mother. Maybe I was being irresponsible by traveling when Cato was so young. Why had we left home? Why hadn't I listened? What would I do if Cato became ill? I felt like I was in the labor ward again, except this time I wasn't trusted to take care of my son. More than lost, I felt guilt. Guilt for not having listened. Guilt for endangering my son. Guilt for not being an obedient daughter. I was being split between the role of daughter-in-law and mother. I had been selfish to make this trip. I hadn't thought about Cato. I hadn't thought about James's family and their anxieties. In my sleepless state, I went over their worries in my mind. What if someone had dropped Cato? What if he'd got sick from the plane? What if? And then there was the constant feeling of being watched, of being monitored. James found out that his parents had installed Nest Cams in their house as well. It linked to mobile phones, and both of James's brothers had access to the audio and visual feed. James was so enraged, he tore the main camera out of the wall. "Why didn't you tell us there was a camera?" he said. I must have looked panicked, because James's mother said, "Why are you so worried, Kat? No one is listening to what you're saying. No one cares." Then she laughed, with her eyes darting. Yes, and that was the problem. No one did care. No one was listening. My words meant nothing in this house, in this whirlwind of noise. I was a blind man's daughter in a deaf man's house. I said this to James, and no one was listening to me. No one was speaking my language. "You're doing great," James told me. "We're doing great. Look at Cato. He's healthy. He's happy. Are we not doing the right thing? Is Cato okay?" I asked. James waved his hands, brushing my concerns aside. He was irritated by his parents, but he didn't seem concerned by the running commentary or the constant questions and criticisms. He just ignored it. It was as though nothing was being said. "Don't worry about them," he said. "They don't mean what they say." But I couldn't stop listening. And it wasn't completely true. His parents did mean what they said. However, what I only slowly began to realize was that they didn't mean their words to be taken seriously. They were used to speaking without being heard. Words were just sounds, not carefully chosen. I started to become paranoid that James's mother was signaling to me in a language separate from the rest of the families. Her exaggerated laughing motions, her darting eyes, they didn't match her words, and I didn't understand. What was she saying to me? What did she mean? Why couldn't James see? "You just have to surrender," James's mother would say frequently, throwing her hands up in the air. "That's the only way to survive being a mother." And I would know it was kindly meant, but each time it felt like a pressing of hands against me, a suffocation. Surrender. I was meant to be a sacrifice. I started to feel the weight of duty on me. I wanted to leave, to escape, but I knew that was impossible. We were bound. I also sensed that with Cato's birth, James's mother felt that her son had fully left and now had another family. I saw it in the way she looked at us, the way her body leaned towards James, the flash of her eyes when James came into the room to hug Cato and me first. "Before you know it, he'll grow up, and he won't want to spend time with you. He'll leave, she said, and I sensed the note of bitterness there. There is a Korean expression that love only flows down, like a river or tears. Love flows from one generation to the next, never the other way. I tried to imagine what it would be like to have Kato grown up, married, starting a family, leaving me behind. I thought of James and his mother. Instead of a line, we were creating circles. In my future, I saw James's mother standing on the other side, reflected towards me. It had been a week since we arrived in New Jersey, and I finally insisted that we needed to leave the house and go to the city. We would take Kato. We have to go, I said to James. Even if they're worried, I need to go. Don't worry what they think, James shrugged. He seemed unbothered, even when his mother tucked antibacterial wipes in our bag, and his father asked us to check Kato's temperature every few hours. We trudged onto the New York bus system, James carrying the pushchair. I had Kato tucked into a sling. For the first time since we arrived in New Jersey, he slept soundly. He was curled in my arms, and I could feel his heartbeat, his breath on my skin. As we walked through Manhattan, I felt like I was letting off a burden of air. I cried in relief at being able to breathe, at being anonymous in the city of faces. No one was looking at me. I felt safe in the blizzard of snow and people. We returned home in the evening. James's parents had been waiting up for us. I could tell from their faces that they had been anxious. I stayed awake that night, listening to their murmurs. The next morning, James's father sat with me. He poured coffee for me, and we sat facing each other at the glass table. He gave me a smile, and I could sense that we were about to have a serious conversation. Does James treat you well? Yes, I said. Okay, good. I know that having a new baby, this is difficult. He paused. Have you heard of postpartum depression? Yes, I said. And then I realized he thought I was depressed. It's very common, he said. 85% of women have it after they have a baby. I think you might have depression. He spoke kindly. His face was grave. I notice that you are worried all the time, that you aren't sleeping. This is dangerous. You need to take care of yourself. I think we are making you feel anxious. I get worried. I worry a lot, and I know I speak roughly. I don't mean to. I started to cry. His diagnosis of what was happening was so accurate. He could see so clearly what was going on. He knew. I have three sons, he said. Of my three, James, he is the most difficult, but he is also the one with the most conviction. You once told me, and he quoted to me the conversation we had the first time we met. You told me that you wanted a husband with kindness and conviction. He has both, and I know that he loves you, and I believe that you are a strong woman. You will get through this. I looked at him, and I saw his hands shake, and I saw his face, and then I realized what had been happening, what I hadn't seen in my state of worry and fear. My father-in-law wasn't worried because of our actions. His anxiety was his own. I saw a man who had seen so many worst-case scenarios, who felt powerless to help and was terrified of having to recognize those signs in the ones he loved. He knew he was an anxious man. He knew that he was always worried. It wasn't Kato he was trying to protect. It was himself. I started to feel like I could breathe. He smiled at me, but then he ended the conversation with his usual tick, the worst-case scenario. In most cases, postpartum depression is not serious, but you have to be careful, because I had a patient who shook her baby. She shook him, and then the baby went blind, and my breath caught in my throat. Koreans say that in the moment between sleep and waking, if you wake, paralyzed and unable to breathe or shout, a ghost is sitting on your chest. I remember being terrified of this feeling, being awake, frozen, and not able to move. I would open my mouth to let out a silent scream, and I'd think of the ghost on my chest. Where had it come from? I would imagine that it was a ghost from generations ago, the ghosts of my grandparents' dreams, the ones that had been taken from them, ghosts of the past, of lives interrupted, of expectation, of yearning, a heavy burden passed down for me to hold. After my conversation with my father-in-law, I went back upstairs. I started to feel as though the air was stiffening. I felt my chest clench, and I had trouble taking in a breath. The ground shifted suddenly, like someone had given a quick shake to the world. I went to feed Cato, holding him close, but then I noticed that my hands were clutching him tightly. Would I suffocate him? Was I holding him too close? His eyes were darting at me. James's eyes, his mother's eyes, they were looking at me with fear. Was I going to shake him? Would I blind him? Was he afraid of me? I tried to put the thought from my mind. It was the feeling that I sometimes got of vertigo, of looking over the edge of a tall building and imagining the fall. My mother-in-law called for me. "Cat," she said. She wanted to talk about Cato's 100-day celebration that was happening in a few days. "A lot of people are talking. There's a lot of drama going on behind the scenes, believe me," she said. I nodded. I could hear their murmurs in my head. "And don't worry, at the 100-day celebration, I'll watch people to make sure they don't drop the baby," she said. "I'll watch very closely." "But," I said, starting to feel my chest tighten, "maybe by watching, you'll make people nervous, and then they will drop him." I thought of the vertigo, the fall. I thought of Leah looking nervously at our balcony when we moved into the new apartment and looking over the edge. The same fear when dreading something, that anticipation, does it make the event inevitable? At that moment, James's father came into the room. James's mother made a laughing motion while her eyes darted to me. And then I saw my mother-in-law as well. Her criticisms, her worries, they weren't because of me. They were because of her own family, and she was doing her best to manage them. And I was the problem. I was the one messing it up by ignoring her cues. She had been asking me to mirror her, to look carefree. All the while, her words were a warning, and her body language was to reassure my father-in-law so that he wouldn't have to worry. Her laughter, it was a pantomime for his benefit, a habit developed in a deaf man's house, to make everything look as though it were running smoothly, just like the silence my brother and I had grown up in. Her darting eyes were her tell, her nerves when things weren't going smoothly as she had planned. Of course, my father-in-law knew what was going on. He knew that there was something at the core of the house, something untrue, something to diagnose. While this was obvious to James and his brothers, to me it was a hard-won conclusion. I couldn't have come to it any other way than consuming every lie, every presumption, until all that was left was the truth. In my mother-in-law, I saw a portrait of contradictions, a woman who loved adventure and had the spirit of a young girl, put into a box of traditional marriage and family. Her family was her center, her axiom, and she loved her husband. She had to follow a dictated path or break completely. She had chosen to adapt, and her constant phrase, "I surrender," it was the truth. She had chosen to surrender, to accept her fate, her happiness. Her son, my husband, was the only one who shared her love of adventure, but he had left her behind, going to London, away from the network of family that she knew and loved. In James's father, I saw James, but an extreme version, a man of knowledge and wisdom and kindness who had been taken over by fear after years of seeing worst-case scenarios. His sense of powerlessness as a doctor caused him to see signs of potential dangers in the everyday, a new dimension ruled by illness and worry. It led him to embrace religion and faith, and he could sense that biblically, his three sons weren't following the path he was hoping for them. And James, like in the fairy tales, the third son, treasured, chosen, loved, was destined to be apart from the other two brothers who were lost in the woods, the only one to emerge. Underneath his happy childhood, I saw a new dimension of darkness to his stories, a constant reminder of mortality, of illness, of seeing symptoms, a reminder of not being in control, a force that shaped my husband into a man of principles and clear thinking, always methodical, always in control, a man who turned away from faith and superstition, who chose to believe only in what was proven, what was evidential. "I fell in love with you at first conversation," he had said, and I finally understood what he meant. In his family, full of love and noise, no one was actually listening. There was too much going on, too many voices and opinions. Noise. And then, even though I didn't feel like it, I mirrored my mother-in-law and made an exaggerated laughing motion. It was like I had been sprinting, and this was the moment when everything came to a sudden stop. The world flipped. Everything changed, but nothing had changed. I believe this was the moment that ultimately triggered my psychosis. I processed all of these things in the single moment that my father-in-law and mother-in-law looked at me and our eyes met. And I saw us, apart from time, our portraits, our mirroring actions. We were all existing, but out of sync with one another, repeating the patterns of the past. Koreans believe in reincarnation and recurrence, souls that are reborn again and again. When my uncle's son was born, he was born with a mind like a kaleidoscope. He doesn't speak, but communicates through drawings and dance, living between worlds. My grandmother had blamed herself. A fortune teller had once told her not to mourn her unborn son, the one who had died in her womb. "He will be born again," she said, "as your grandson." And so my grandmother had wished, had waited. And then when my uncle's son was born, she thought, the living incarnation of her dead son, of course he wouldn't belong to the land of the living. She was being punished for questioning the fates, for wishing too much. I wonder whether James's grandmother had looked for her eldest son in the eyes of her grandsons. His name would have shared a character with James's grandfather's name and his father before. A wish traced back generations. A wish interrupted. I think that perhaps, even though they fear it, Koreans wish for recurrence. They yearn and they wait. They live like ghosts. They wish for the past to become their present. I went back upstairs and tried to catch my breath. Everything would be fine now. I had figured it out. But I felt like I had downloaded too much information, and I was still processing, catching up. Three sons, diagnoses, mirroring actions, darting eyes. I looked at Cato sleeping peacefully in his cot. I wanted to hold him, and I leaned over to pick him up, but then his eyes opened, and then it happened. His eyes turned to devil's eyes, dark eyes with flashing red pupils. A flash, and then his eyes, James's eyes, James's mother's eyes, darted towards me with fear. I tried breathing again, but my breaths were becoming short. The walls felt thicker. I hadn't understood the expression about walls closing in, but it felt like they were now. "James," I gasped. He came into the room, and I saw his eyes widen when he saw my face. I told him that we needed to leave the house, now. "I can't breathe," I said to him. "Please trust me. I need to leave." He paused. "I need to leave now." "Okay," he said. "Okay, let's leave." I felt a window opening in my mind. We were going to leave. We would be fine. I had thought that leaving the house was impossible, but James had just opened a door. "Can I pack?" he asked. "Would it be okay for me to pack our things so that we can go?" "Yes, yes," I said. I started gasping and sobbing. "I need you to look at me straight on," I said. "I need you to not look at me like I'm crazy, or I'm going to fall apart, I swear." His eyes were still trusting. They were still all right. But I didn't know what I would do if James's eyes changed too. "I need you to repeat exactly what I say, word for word," I said. I needed to know that he would understand me completely, that there would be no more misunderstandings, no more side languages. I needed to know that we were all speaking the same language, on the same plane. Yes, he said. I will repeat exactly what you say. Word for word, I said. Word for word. Cato was crying quietly, and so I picked him up, but I didn't look at his eyes. I sat on the bed, holding him, while James packed our things methodically. There was a question I remember from middle school. Who would you trust to pack your parachute? And I always knew, when I met James, that he would be the one I would trust. He was talking to himself as he laid out each of our things and separated them. Somehow, he packed all our bags within minutes. It was as though he had been prepared all along to escape at any moment. And then I had a thought. James and his bag, the one he always had. I had teased him for never being without his backpack. But maybe there had been a reason he was always ready to leave, always ready to escape. Was this his childhood? One that was claustrophobic from stress and anxiety? He used to tell me that some of his happiest memories were walking into town alone, spending the day walking to the drugstore, reading comic books. And I saw another dimension to that story. I had never thought to ask why he'd left the house, why he wanted to be alone. But I realized that it was a reminder to himself that he was in control. "We're going to a hotel," he said, "unless you want to go back to London." "No, no," I said. "I'll be fine. There's no need to overcorrect. I just need to get out of this house." He nodded. "Repeat, please," I begged. "Okay," he said. "There's no need to overcorrect. You just need to get out of the house." He thought for a moment, and then he took out his phone and booked a hotel, one that was a few minutes away. I felt the weight, that weight lifting from my chest. I didn't look at Cato. I didn't dare, but I felt him shuffle in my arms. What did it mean that his eyes had changed? What was happening? But it was going to be all right now. We were leaving. It had seemed impossible, but we were doing it. Generations of duty and obedience, and we were leaving. Just like that. Could my grandmother feel this? This liberation? We were leaving in a stream of ribbons. We were escaping this loop, this repeating pattern of mothers and sons, of fear. I thought of James's mother's story of her brother who had died from hot soup falling on him, of my mother trapped in her in-law's house. We would break this pattern. I could hear James's parents downstairs. I heard them speaking to one another. "I can't see your parents," I said. The weight was back again. I started to gasp. The walls were closing in again. I was becoming trapped again. We were going to stay in this loop. This loop, repeating loop. "You can't see my parents," he said. "Okay." He rushed downstairs, and I heard him speak to his parents. The front door opened, and I heard them leave the house and drive away. "What did you say to them?" I asked. "Don't worry about it," he said. "No, I need you to be honest with me. I need you to tell me," I said. "I need to know that you believe me, that you trust me." I just told them that we need to leave, and that I needed them to leave the house for a while. I started to breathe again. I could feel Cato against me, his heartbeat. It would be fine. We would get out of this. I didn't know what was happening to me, but it was as though the world was being shaken fiercely like a snow globe, and I was the only one who had a sense of balance. I was holding on to James as hard as I could. I needed him to believe me, to reassure me that I was still in reality. Maybe I was having a panic attack. Maybe I was just dreaming. I couldn't be sure. Why was the world compressing? James loaded the spare car, the one with duct tape windows and boot. He took Cato from me, and I noticed that my hands were shaking. I still couldn't look at Cato. I was running away, away from the house, away from this place. I sat in the front seat and tried to concentrate on breathing. The houses were repeating, the same versions of neighborhoods, and I started thinking about what Matt had said about his house, the repeating houses. And I thought of A Wrinkle in Time, and the description of the houses and the children bouncing balls in sync with each other in the driveways. Would we ever be able to escape? Were we just staying in the same moment, in the same place? We finally passed the town center, and I was still gasping for breath. I expected the sky to suddenly open. When we got to the hotel, James said to let him check in. I sat with Cato on the patterned couch in the lobby, counting my breaths, hoping that the world would stop shaking. Two Korean men in suits approached me. "We're looking for my phone," one of them said in Korean. Were they? A thought flashed through my head. Were they friends of James's parents? Were we under surveillance? What if word got back to James's family that we had been seen at a hotel? Would they be able to deal with the scandal? The hotel looked like a seedy hotel from the movies, with red carpeting and textured red walls. I thought I could hear the thrum of surveillance cameras. Were we being watched? I imagined a room of screens and our images multiplied. We were being tracked, I thought. What if people were looking at my Instagram, at my Facebook, and analyzing everything we were doing? I was friends with James's cousins on Facebook. Is that what my mother-in-law meant? Was that what she was warning me about when she said people were talking? My hands shook as I deleted my Facebook and Instagram apps. I decided to delete my WhatsApp history as well. They were watching us. "What are you doing?" James asked. He looked at me. He was holding the room key. "I'm deleting everything," I said. "I just need some time to myself." He nodded slowly. As we walked down the red corridors, I thought I could hear murmuring from the other rooms, from behind the doors. I heard the buzz of cameras in the corners. "I've always wanted to stay here," James said. I tried to nod. In my arms, Cato was stirring. I glanced down at him. His eyes were devil's eyes. My roommate Liz is blonde and in her 40s. She spends her time shivering in her bed, only emerging for mealtimes, which she shuffles to with a yawn, rubbing her eyes. She has a book next to her bed. A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. I ask her if I can borrow it. "Sure," she says, but her eyes narrow. I can tell that I've broken a rule. Personal belongings are off limits. "Just for a second," I say quickly. "It's one of my favorites." "I've heard it's good. I haven't really had much time to read it." There is a bookmark on the second page. I thumb through the pages. It's miraculously clean and unmarked when everything in the ward is worn through. She asks me to read out loud. My voice is shaky. The words are skipping off the page in my vision. But for a moment, we are both on the fire escape of a tenement building in New York. "That was nice," she says. "Thank you for letting me read," I say. I try something tonight. I hold the liquid and pill in my mouth. I don't swallow them. I walk quickly to my room, and I spit into the sink. I want to feel. I don't want to fall asleep in a fog. I want to know what's happening. Around me, I sense the mood in the ward changing as everyone settles down, calm, sedated. The pace slows. People stop talking so much. There's the sound of the television, and then one by one, we pad along to our rooms to sleep. I'm one of the last, but I follow along. Step, step, 1-2, 1-2. Above us, the fluorescent lighting hums. For a moment, I remember pacing in the labor ward with Cato in my arms, singing him songs that my grandmother used to sing. I remember the sound of the lights, the press of his body against mine, the promise of morning. I press my arms crossed against my heart. There's a sharp ache in my chest, and I'm trying to stop it. Lights are out in the ward. I can hear Liz snoring. The room is dank, and a small dresser in the corner is making strange shadows. My bed frame is metal. I can feel its bones sticking through the mattress. The bed sheets are thin and rough. They scratch my skin. It's dark, but there are angles of light coming in from the doors. From far away, I hear screaming and the faint sounds of footsteps. I hear the doors opening and closing. I feel empty, and from deep within, I feel a sense of yearning. I turn to my side. I almost expect to see Cato in a plastic cot next to me, swaddled in his hospital blanket. I wonder if he realizes I'm gone. The thought makes me feel nauseated. I hope he doesn't realize. It's better that he forgets. I try to picture Cato's face, but I can't. I only see his eyes, James's eyes, James's mother's eyes. I hear my mother-in-law's voice. What was it that she'd always say? I surrender. Should I surrender to my thoughts? I don't think I can, whatever that might mean. I feel compressed. I think of the locks on the doors, the heaviness of the doors. I try to count my breaths slowly, and I want to think of home, but I can't. Instead, I think of my grandfather's compound in Korea and the summers I spent there as a child. The compound was built on the side of a hill with a campus and church lined with bamboo groves. At the top of the hill was a house made of red brick. In the summer heat, the house was stifling. We would stay indoors, standing in front of the air conditioning unit, playing chess with the African stone pieces, which were cool in our hands. At twilight, we would run in the backyard amongst the black marble tombstones. The names on the stones were written in Korean. The graves were empty. They represented the parents that my grandparents had left behind in North Korea. We'd lie on the cool marble, pressing our cheeks against the chiseled stone. I could hear the sound of my heartbeat against it, echoing against the rock. We would play in the shadows until it became night. I think of this now as I count my heartbeat in the ward. The dark is like glass, bright splinters of light from the hallway in our room. And I think of my ancestors, who were a mystery to me. I didn't know their stories. My only link to them is in my DNA, in the shape of my hands, the reflection of my eyes. What did they feel? What did they imagine? Had this happened before? It felt so familiar, pre-written somehow. And nearby, in a dark like this one, James and Cato are sleeping, away from me, but along the same line of the globe. I think of my great aunt, who always slept with her feet pointed north, in the direction of where she longed to be. She had left her husband and son in the north. Her son had just learned to walk. They were separated in a moment of fate, never to be reunited. My great aunt never forgave herself. Why had she insisted on traveling ahead? She should have waited. She died without remarrying. She thought each day might be the day that they would meet again. They would meet again, she said. She knew it. She only worried that her son wouldn't recognize her with her white hair. I think of love, my fascination with love stories, and my grandmother's warning. I used to think that her warning was about men like Drew, the violence, the cruelty, the emotion parading as love. But I think it was a warning against something purer. She meant what she said. It was a warning against the triumph of love. Because something so beautiful, so raw, can only end. To bear one's heart is to know suffering, vulnerability. It is a destructive force. That's what makes it beautiful, to know mortality and failure, but to step off the edge anyway. When we arrived at the hotel room, I immediately wanted to leave. It was all wrong. The walls were too red. They were humming. There were plastic flowers gasping to live. There was a television screen that was a shadow in the corner. I could hear whispers from the hallway. My breath felt uneven again. James started to unpack the bags. Please sleep, he begged me. I just want you to get some rest, and then we can talk. I shook my head. No, I couldn't sleep. I couldn't stay in this room. I can't, I shouted. Around me, the patterns on the wall were running, scampering across the red. The room was spinning, but only we were standing still. I thought I could see figures running, running as fast as they could out of the room. I felt trapped. I was on a balcony again, and I wanted to leap. Couldn't James see what the stakes were? The world was shaking, and somehow I needed to escape, to walk, to be away from the suffocating feeling. I felt like the walls were turning and turning, that I was stuck in a mirror of reflecting images, of reflecting lives. I didn't want to tell James about Cato's eyes, because I didn't know what I would do if James looked at me with fear as well. I tried to take a deep breath. James was watching me. "I need to call Teddy," I said. "He will understand." And he would understand, I thought. He was the only one that could. I knew that he saw me for me, not as a mother, not as a wife, just Catherine, Nuna. I took my phone and went into the bathroom to call Teddy. It was 5 a.m. in Seattle, but he picked up the phone. "Hi, Nuna." "Teddy," I said. My breaths were coming in gasps. He waited. "I can't breathe, Teddy," I said. "I don't know what's happening. Something's really wrong. Everything is closing in. I'm not sure what's happening, but it feels like everything is strange, almost like it's all happened before." There was a pause. "Do you know what I mean?" "Yes." "What do you do when you have that feeling?" I said. "Well, mostly you have to find a reason to laugh. You have to find it absurd." "I'm trying to laugh," I said, "but it just feels too serious, too dark. I'm not sure what's real." "Okay," he said. I knew that with Teddy, I had to wait. I looked at myself in the bathroom mirror. I looked the same, like normal. "Nuna, just be calm. Where are you right now?" "I'm in a hotel with James and Cato," I said. "In a hotel?" The words tumbled out of me as I told him that we had left James's parents' house, that James had done the impossible thing and got us out of there. He had broken the rules of duty and obedience. We had done the impossible. I had been a blind man's daughter in a deaf man's house, and we had done the impossible. But something was still wrong. "Nuna, can I talk to James?" Teddy asked. James was sitting on the bed, worriedly, with Cato. He looked at me with tired eyes, but they were still his eyes. They were still trusting. "It's Teddy," I said. James handed Cato to me and left the room. I sat with my head leaning against Cato's. I could feel his breath warm against my cheek. His skin was soft, softer than powder. He was still trusting, still leaning against me. James came back into the room. He handed me the phone. He gave me a half smile. "Nuna," Teddy said, "I think you need to sleep. I know that when I don't sleep, it really affects my thinking." "Yes," I said. "I agree, but I can't sleep right now. I need to breathe. I need to walk. I can't breathe in this room." I could hear my voice in my head. I was sounding desperate. "Okay, Nuna, just be calm. You'll be fine. Just listen to James. Whatever he says, just listen to James." I pictured Teddy as a child, a small boy, my foxhole buddy. "You know, Teddy, you were always my foxhole buddy." He laughed. "I know. You're right. Nuna, you'll be okay." I hung up the phone and looked at James. He looked weary and uncertain. I wanted to see Teddy. I wanted to ask him to fly here, to remind me that everything would be okay. "Maybe Teddy should come," James said to me, as if he knew what I was thinking. "No," I said. "No, don't bother him." James tried to smile at me. "If you can't sleep, why don't we go on a tour of my hometown?" he said. It was something we had talked about, his childhood, and how if we had met in high school, he would have taken me on a high school date. "Why don't we go on a high school date?" he said. "We can take Cato." "Yes," I thought. "Yes, we could do this. I could do this." Leaving the room felt like a test, but we stepped out into the hall, and I could feel my heart, a closed fist in my chest. I immediately felt relieved. This was going to be fine. I was going to be fine. We packed Cato carefully into the car. He looked at me innocently. His eyes had no hint of the devilishness that they had before. He cooed at me, and I smiled back at him. We would be fine. James drove, and I stayed in the back seat next to Cato with my hand on his leg. We drove down the streets of Tenafly, past the bagel shops, the delis, and diners. We parked the car on a side street and took Cato out in the pushchair. James led me to the drugstore where he used to read comic books. I used to come here all the time when I was a kid, he said. He smiled, but he looked exhausted as we walked in. Let's buy some supplies, he said. He was moving slowly, as though in a dream. Perhaps he felt the weight of what we had done, I thought. Perhaps he felt the weight of leaving. As he stood by the shelves, I looked at James carefully. I noticed that he had eczema on his face and hands. He pulled out an inhaler. He never had to use one in London, but after a few days in New Jersey, his asthma had returned. He took a deep breath with the inhaler. I used to spend hours here, he said. And I suddenly saw him as a young boy with an oversized backpack, finding silence in the drugstore aisle, with chapped lips and shaggy hair, away from noise, away from diagnoses. The colors in the pharmacy started to feel too bright. What was happening? I could feel the walls moving, closing, pulsing. I started to see demons' faces in the drugstore aisles. An older woman with a walking frame stared at me, and her face was distorted. One eye was bulging out of her face. The eye socket was open, no eyelid, and her nose was long and hooked. What was happening? I couldn't tell if it was my imagination. I started to look around the drugstore shelves. The boxes seemed like they were pulsing too. The colors were vibrant, too vibrant. The words on the pharmacy signs were flashing at me. Relief, pain, escape. What was going on? Was I dreaming? I looked at James. He was still focused on the supplies. He didn't seem to notice what was happening. He moved slowly towards me and smiled at me again. I could feel my breath constricting. I need to go back to the hotel, I said. Okay, he said. He looked relieved. Let's sleep. I'm exhausted. I think Cato is exhausted too. I looked at Cato sleeping peacefully in his pushchair, and then I realized, Cato, I had forgotten about him. We left the drugstore without buying anything. I walked quickly to the doorway. It was pouring rain. The sky was dark. There hadn't been any thunder or lightning. No warning. Just torrents. When did this happen? The rain was dark. It was pelting the ground. What should we do? I asked. I could feel the eyes of the old woman staring at me behind us. She sounded like she was trying to talk to me. I ignored her. James didn't seem to notice the rain. He stood hesitantly. Let's just go, he said, and he took out an umbrella from underneath the pushchair. We walked slowly, sheltering the pushchair and trying to make sure that Cato wouldn't get wet. As we walked to the car, I wondered whether this was a dream. Was this a test? Should we wait out the storm? How would James's father feel if his anxiety caused us to leave the house, I wondered, only for us to die in an accident? It would be his version of hell, I thought. James took a deep breath before he started the car. In the car, I saw the sharp blurs of lightning and started counting, but I couldn't hear the thunder. It was raining so hard, there was only the sound of the rain. I started counting my breaths instead. I could feel Cato's breathing in the car seat next to me. His eyes were closed. He was peaceful. I could feel James concentrating. He was trying his hardest. The rain was coming down faster, so we could only see the headlights of the cars ahead. I thought of the quote from the Charlie Brown comic. Security is the feeling of being in the back seat of the car while your parents are driving. And I thought, if I were to die at this moment, I had a sense of peace. Cato's hands were grasping my finger. We were safe. I trusted James. I knew that he would get us back safely. I felt like I was floating, calm. I feel like we escaped something, James said as we walked into the lobby. Yes, I said. The hotel lobby was wrong. I felt it like a jolt going through my body. It was crowded with people, so many people, and they were all turning their heads to look at me. Why were they looking at me? As I walked through them, they were pushing into me, jostling me. Some of them had distorted faces like the woman in the drugstore. Some of them smiled at me with shining eyes. And then there was Cato's face in the crowd, but twisted into a demon's face, with a disfigured mouth and dancing eyes. I shut my eyes. What was this trick? I refused to believe it. I held onto James's arm, and when we were in front of the hotel room, I ran in and closed the door. The room sounded like it was breathing.